Hello, my name is Dr. Christian Heim.
And my name is Dr. Caroline Heim.
We've got some exciting news.
We'll be talking about all things relationship.
All things relationship.
All things relationship.
That's a lot to talk about, Caroline.
Well, we've got a lot of talk shows to talk about it.
We have a lot of talk shows to talk about it, but what we are going to do is we're going to look at a study that has been done on relationships so that everything is backed by the science that we talk about here, and then we'll be looking at how you can apply some of that science into your life and into your relationship, and we will be looking at those relationship issues that perhaps we all come across and need a little bit of help in from time to time, Caroline.
Yeah, so it's really for people that are perhaps struggling in their relationship or want to make their relationship better, whether you're just starting out in a relationship, you're 20 years in, you're 50 years in. It's actually for anyone that's in a relationship, in a long-term relationship or wants to be in a long-term relationship.
And it's not only for people who are struggling, not only for people who are looking at a relationship, but if you're in a good relationship, hey, there's nothing wrong with making a good thing better.
Absolutely.
So we will see you, or you will hear us, on Friday night, 9 p.m.
Friday night, ET, so New York time, at 9 p.m.
Hello, everybody. My name is Dr. Christian Heim, and I'm a clinical psychiatrist.
And my name is Dr. Caroline Heim, and I'm an associate professor.
And together, we research what keeps your relationship together for longer.
That's right. That's what we do. And today, this is episode 2 of our Resilient Relationships talk show. So what are we talking about today, Christian?
Well, Caroline, we're still in the introductory phase. So we are here to explain, I suppose, a bit of our core research. So we have researched people who have been together for more than 40 years, and we've asked them what makes their relationship resilient.
That's right.
And so we published the findings in a study of 2023.
That's right. So the study was called How Did You Stay Together So Long? Relationship Longevity, a Cross-Generational Qualitative Study. And that was in the Journal of Marital and Family Therapy. So that was published in October. And we're going to be talking a little bit about that study today, aren't we?
Yes. So every episode, we want to give you the science. We want to give you the application, how you can apply the science to your relationship at the time. And along the way, we'll have stories about couples who have done it well. And in this particular episode, yes, we're talking about this study, but we're going to talk about how we put it together and studies that were like it in the past before we can see what this means to you. So we want to give you these secrets. These are the results that let you know what has helped couples stay together 40, 50, and 60 years.
That's right. So we actually started off with asking young people what that they actually wanted to do, what they actually wanted to...
So we're going to put together an introduction as to how we actually did this study. So in Caroline's work, she works with young people at a university. And this podcast is for young people who want to keep their relationships together, or when they get into a relationship, they will know what to do to keep a relationship together in the long run, because some of us that have been together for a while know that it's not always too easy.
It isn't. It certainly isn't.
So how do we put the study together, Caroline?
Okay, so what we did is we asked 137 people that were together, so not necessarily married, but together in a relationship, cohabitating 3 to 15 years. And then we asked them the question, if you could ask anyone that was married 40 plus years a question, what would it be? And then we got those questions and we asked 180 coupled individuals. So this was actually 90 couples, the questions that they asked.
Okay, so I'll go over that because that's important, because what we actually tried to do was put together an intergenerational dialogue. So we asked young people who've been in fairly new relationships or relationships that are what we call medium term, what do you need to know? And we asked them, what would they like to ask couples that have been together a long time if they could? So the reason that we're doing that is because we're in a society that doesn't always support relationships. We're getting the message that being in one relationship is not that much fun, or it should be a lot easier than it actually is. Whereas being in a relationship is actually quite a bit of effort, but it's worthwhile effort. So that's what the study's about.
That's right. And we wanted to ask the young people, because these were ones that actually really wanted to find out how to have a long-term relationship.
Yeah, so we were actually overwhelmed that so many of the young couples really just wanted to know the answer to one particular question.
Which was the number one question, actually.
Number one, yeah.
Which was, how did you do it? What is your secret? What is your glue? How did you stay together so long? And that was actually over 60% of the young couples wanted to ask that question.
Yeah. Yeah. So overwhelmingly, this was the most important question, which says a lot in itself. What it says is that young people want to be in one relationship that will last. Mm. And could you please give us the tools?
Yeah.
Could you please give us the secrets? Please let us know how you did it, guys, because we want to do it too.
That's right. So then we went and asked the older couples, and so what the actual answers were. And
all right.
So where are we going to go from here?
Where are we going to go from here? From here, we're going to say that we got 19 different responses.
17 different responses.
So what we do is we look at all the responses and kind of put them into categories, and we found 17 different categories, which tells us one thing, that different things work for different people.
That's right.
However, there were a top three.
Most definitely.
That say a lot about all relationships. And in a way, they're the key glue ingredients that we believe all relationships would benefit from by having these three things. So number one was?
Commitment. That's no surprise. Commitment.
Yeah, we'll unflesh a bit of what commitment actually is, because it's not that easy a concept. The number two thing was?
Altruism.
Now, altruism is selflessness, the ability to be able to give to somebody else outside of yourself.
Mm.
And the importance of that is, in a society that is encouraging all of us, almost demanding of all of us, to live our own lives, a self-centered project is what life is becoming. How do you keep a relationship together?
That's right.
And the answer is to be able to give to other people.
That's right. Well, that's what our couple said.
That's what our couple said.
They'd been married 40 plus years. Some of them had been married even 73 years. Can you believe that? 73 years. That
wow.
Is an amazing innings that the gentleman was 100 years old.
100 years old.
From Bulgaria. Actually, that's one thing I didn't say, that the countries represented, there was 24 different countries represented. So we were interviewing people from all around the world, different nationalities, different cultural backgrounds, which had different approaches to marriage too. So,
Yep. So lot to flesh out here, but we're going to talk about the number three thing.
Yes, the number three thing is shared values.
Shared values.
Mm.
Okay, shared values.
All right.
That actually is quite important, because those three things, commitment means you've got two people saying, yes, we're going to continue this relationship. Altruism is kind of what they need to do to keep that together. And shared values are the things that you forge together to actually make it work.
That's right.
However, let's put it into the context of all studies like ours, because there's, what, been 80, 90 years of studies like this?
Yes, the very first study was actually in 1938, when they started looking at what really makes long-term relationships last.
Okay, all right, I'm going to interrupt you just for a sec, because just to put it into context, our study is part of a actual small group of studies that look at what goes right in relationships.
That's right.
Rather than what goes wrong in relationships.
Yeah, so it's called actually a salutogenic approach.
Oh, it's a big word, yeah.
It's a big word. It's a fun word.
That's
I love
a fun
it.
Word.
Salutogenic. It's a great word.
Can I have some salutogenic and pepper on my meals tomorrow?
Yeah. It's a nice condiment. Yeah, so, and that's basically what goes right in relationships, as opposed to a pathogenic approach, which is, well, it looks more at divorces and what goes wrong in relationships.
And the significance of that is that most of the things or tips that you'll get from relationship therapists and psychologists and researchers are based on pathogenic approaches.
That's right.
So it's looking at what you need to avoid to make sure that your relationship stays on track. But we're part of a small group of people that look at what goes right, because unless you know what to aim for, what are the ingredients that we need to make it go right, then you can kind of go off track and not even know it. And I got to say, these secrets are not only scientifically sound, because all of the things that our couples told us reflect the science of what we know about relationships, and that's another podcast in itself because that's changing, but it also gives you something to aim for in your relationship.
That's right, absolutely, because it's a positive. They've made it through, and what are those keys? What are those secrets?
All right, so let's go back to 1938.
Okay, 1938, a wonderful study by Terman. Sample size was over 1,000 coupled individuals. And he actually asked what really makes you happy. So not, you know, what is your glue, what is your secret, but what makes you happy?
Yeah.
And a lot of these studies actually look at that, very similar to some of the things that we ask. But the findings were, in the 1930s, this is interesting to look at, affection, philosophy of life, and friendship.
Okay, affection, philosophy and of life, and friendship. Now, asking what makes you happy is looking at what we call relationship satisfaction. And Caroline and I work in the area of relationship longevity. So in other words, we look at the area of what keeps relationships together in the long term. The idea, of course, is that you do want your relationship happy in the long term.
Absolutely.
And there's kind of a underlying assumption that if you're in an unhappy relationship, that it's not going to last in the long term.
Yeah.
And if you look at satisfaction, in other words, keeping your relationship happy, you will actually last in the long term. So it's not a direct relationship, but if you can keep your relationship what we call satisfied, it will stay together better in the long term.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, so that was 1938.
Okay, that's the 1930s. And then we actually had a dearth of studies right up until the 1970s. And they started looking at happiness again. And some of the, I guess they were looking a bit more of some of the secrets in the 70s. So a very interesting study in the 1970s by Stinnett et al. And that was, again, surveys. And they found that it was, for the 70s, love, determination, and shared interests.
Love, determination, shared interests. All right, so to my way of thinking, you've got to ask the question, why did we go we went four decades without a study
in this
area.
That's right, exactly. What was going on?
Well, we had a couple of wars.
We did.
Right? So, but also, society, particularly in the USA, was really very stable.
Mm.
It was only at in the 60s that things started to change again, and in the 70s we're still looking at a period before we had no-fault divorce laws.
Mm, mm.
So the stability of the marriage laws reflected the need for the studies, or the lack of a need for studies.
That's right.
Because marriages were staying together if you like it or not.
That's right.
And for most people that's okay, but for a minority of people that also meant unhappy marriages.
That's true.
And
that's
it's true. The idea of unhappy marriages and suppression in a marriage that drove the introduction of no-fault divorce laws, first in California, we're talking about the late 70s, but then basically across the whole world by the time you get to the mid-80s.
That's right, and that's when we get the plethora of studies.
That's
okay?
When we get the plethora of
Whoa,
studies.
Oh, boy. Okay, 80s and 90s, actually. And for the first time in these studies, I mean, we've got about eight studies coming out of that period. At the first time, we're actually getting the word commitment
yes.
as one of the reasons for happiness or what makes a marriage last, is commitment.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to put this into a social context because the way that I see it is that the studies reflect what's going on in society.
Yes.
And now that we have divorce and the ability to be able to separate from somebody, when you ask couples, well, what keeps it together? That's when this word commitment becomes really important.
Mm,
and we found it in our study. It was still the number one
thing. Still number one.
But if you just assume that all society is going to stay together, which is what was happening in the 1930s and 40s, then commitment doesn't feature that much.
That's right.
Okay, so the point that I'm trying to make, if I'm right, is that the divorce laws drove the ideas that we have as to what makes a good marriage.
Yeah.
And commitment is one of those things.
Most definitely one of those things. So then we actually don't have a lot of studies on for the next sort of 10 years until 2015. This is a study by Pillemer. He actually, it's a large study. He's a gerontologist and he looked at he interviewed some very wise Americans, older Americans, and asked them a lot of questions. And there was one relationship question. So the study wasn't on relationships per se, but that was one of the questions. And this is the first time where we see the word communication come in. So one of the findings of what makes you happy and what makes, you know, you stay together was communication was number one. Commitment was number three, but communication, so commitment was still there, but communication was number one.
Okay, so having worked in the area of couples therapy, particularly where mental illness is part of the picture,
yes,
the word communication comes up often, and indeed it came up in our study as number four, yeah?
It was number four.
Good communication. So good communication is up there. But it's very interesting that it came up as number one in 2015.
Yeah.
And by that stage, look, I think the influence of couple therapists and psychologists telling the public what you need to have a good relationship was coming through. Because in the 1990s, that's basically where the couples therapy was. The cognitive behavioral couples therapy was saying that what we need to do is have good communication to have a good relationship. Now, the later science is actually saying that that's not actually the case.
Right.
That if you have what's called bad communication in your relationship, you can still have a good relationship. And I think that's a good thing.
I think that's a great thing, because even if you argue, you can still stay together. I mean, was another finding we have. We're not going to go there yet.
Oh, we won't go there, but just a little teaser for a coming episode. Arguing is not bad communication.
That's right.
Arguing can actually be, and most often is, good communication. It's just loaded with emotion.
That's right. And competition, a sense of competition. There's a lot of things with arguing that come in.
Oh, you had to bring in the competition.
I did. I'm sorry. I had to get one up on you there. By the way, we are married. 33 years, isn't it?
Yes, we
didn't
are.
Say that.
Wonderful. Okay, so are we up to date on the studies?
We are. We're up to date. So the Pillemer was really the last significant study. So these, all the studies I've been citing that we've looked at are with sample sizes of 100 and more or more. So, you know, they're the ones that really we've looked at, that have looked at longevity, really.
So we've looked at longevity, and when Caroline went through all of those, what we call a literature review, it shows a few things, that there are not many studies in this area. The fact that we could go through 80 years worth of studies in about 10 minutes to look at the major ones shows that there's not really much evidence in this area.
That's right.
And also, most all of these studies, correct me if I'm wrong, most all of these studies are done by surveys?
Yes, I would say about two-thirds of surveys.
Okay, so some are interviews?
Yes, and I do need to actually qualify that these are cross-sectional studies rather than
longitudinal
studies. So that is the difference too, because the numbers change in longitudinal studies and it's looking at different aspects. So these are of the cross-sectional studies on longevity.
So a cross-sectional study takes a snapshot of how a relationship is right now, whereas a longitudinal study will grab some couples, not literally, of course.
Come here. I want to survey you.
And keep them in a study for years, even decades, to see how things are going. And that's not the area that we're in. We're in the snapshot area.
We are.
Because we like photography.
We do. And also, one of the values of the cross-sectional study is the contextualization. So we're getting a snapshot of what marriages are like in this 21st century at this time,
too. At this time, yes. Yeah. And this brings us back to the book that we mentioned last episode, in which it's called Resilient Relationships, Techniques for Surviving Hyperindividualism, Social Isolation, and a Mental Health Crisis. And what that does is contextualize our findings in the society that we find ourselves at the moment. Because what our study did was it gained some wisdom from people who've been together longer, but they actually forged their relationships in a different society, in a society of 40, even 50 years ago.
That's right.
So how do younger couples like yourself find a relationship and keep a relationship in today's society? That's the problem that we've got to find out. But the first thing that we start off with is our first three findings.
That's right. So the young people have asked those questions. Some even said, how is it even possible? How do you even do it? You know, I can't believe that you could stay together that long.
Yeah, that's right.
They were blown away by that.
Yep.
Because they perhaps couldn't even keep a relationship together for 40 days, let alone 40 years.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that is today's society. And you're battling against the tide. And I suppose that's the first take-home message. To even be in a relationship seems to be countercultural.
That's right.
And yet, one of our catchphrases, if you like, is one of the best things or one of the most selfish things that two people can do for each other is to take care of their relationship.
That's right.
Because it means not only a good relationship, but longer life, better health, better mental health, more emotional well-being, and a whole host of benefits. Less addictions, less loneliness, the ability to grow and share and move forward and even have a good framework for children.
Okay, and all of those things that Christian just cited obviously have a lot of research behind them. He's citing things that actually have the numbers behind them saying, yes, it is better for your health.
And we're going to get into the science of those particular things in coming episodes. Today, we want to concentrate particularly on those first three findings that we had.
Commitment.
Altruism and shared values.
That's right. Okay, so let's jump into commitment. Let's talk about what commitment is first, and then we'll talk about, is that what we're going to do?
Well, I'm a male. I don't know what commitment is.
Oh, there are males out there that do. There are males out there that definitely know what commitment is.
Okay, so let's look at the science of commitment phobia.
Okay,
Because there is science behind commitment phobia, and the science does let us know that males of today do have a problem committing.
Mm.
And there are a few reasons for that. And the bottom line of the science is that when you think that you have options and ongoing options, and because we're all connected to the internet, because we can all find somebody new, and we live in a world of 8 billion people at the moment, that the lack of commitment is driven a lot by the existence of the internet and the perception, not the reality, that there is a lot of choice out there, that I can have whoever I want.
Okay. So is that where commitment phobia comes from then?
That's what the science is showing.
Okay.
Is one of the main drivers. It's not the only thing. Obviously, there's a lot of individual variability.
Yes.
As you said, there are some guys who are just looking to commit. They're looking to have a family and they would like that stability.
Mm.
But if we look at the science, and I suppose the science has to do with the population, everybody rather than the individual. And I got to say, as a psychiatrist, I'm interested in the individual or in the individual couple. What could a couple do to have a good long relationship?
Yeah.
So the number one thing is commitment.
Commitment. Okay. So then we talk to the couples and the older couples.
Yeah, yeah.
And
What did they tell us commitment
well,
was?
Well, they told us all sorts of things. Actually, I'd like to talk about one couple that had really been through an incredible amount. This is an Australian couple that had been married for 40 years. They both had childhood sexual abuse, infertility issues, PTSD. They had been, and this is to quote them, to hell and back again. And so Carol, one of the female in the relationship, said many times they had to go back to their vows, she had to go back to her vows, and through thick and thin, you keep them. And then she said it would have been easy to walk away.
Yeah, and I suppose that becomes part of the definition of commitment. It's always easy to walk away.
Yeah.
But why not?
Why not walk away?
Yeah, why not walk away?
Yeah, so it was more commitment. She said, I wanted to make this work. I believe in staying with my partner for long term. Yes, we're going through so much, but, I want to make this work. There was this incredible determination in both of them. I mean, they actually argued during the interview too.
Yeah.
And I could see they really hadn't got it together.
Yeah.
And this is after 40 years.
They hadn't
okay?
got it together.
I really do not think, and they still said they were a work in progress. They shared some of the joys and the successes they'd had, but they were still battling.
Okay. So to me, that's actually really quite interesting that it shows that a relationship, even after 30, 40 years, is a work in progress. And some people may have the expectation that once you get married or into a long-term relationship, that it's going to be happy ever after.
Mm-hmm.
There's still that expectation because we're all in love with an ideal. But the idea that it's a work in progress and that it continues to be a work in progress, even for people who've been together for such a long time, is kind of a take-home message.
Yeah.
So you're not committing to the happily ever after. You're committing to the work in progress.
That's right.
So let's give some sort of a definition of commitment.
Yes.
Commitment is an undertaking to continue the relationship.
Yeah.
And there were a couple therapy researchers who put together a nice definition that said that commitment has to do with an undertaking to nurture the relationship and not to harm the relationship.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So, again, a salutogenic approach.
it is, because that's what you've got to do to make it go right.
Yeah. So that's great. That's wonderful.
Okay. But how do you express that? And when people hear the word commitment, they think of a wedding day, they think of vows, they think of a piece of paper saying, here we are together. And what the couples have told us actually echoes what the scientific studies show, that commitment is not a one-off historic pledge.
Yeah.
It is something that you show day by day through two things: availability and responsiveness.
Oh, that's so good. Availability and responsiveness. And I mean, that's echoed in all of the stories of the couples that shared, you know, just being there for my partner, always being there and being available.
Okay, so just that everybody knows, it was Caroline who interviewed all 90 couples.
Mm.
So she has those stories. She has her finger on the pulse as to what actually went on in those interviews and what the couples actually said.
Mm.
Whereas I tend to look at the broader picture and what the science actually says about things. So when we're talking about availability and responsiveness, availability, you've actually got to be there.
That's right.
Right? You've just got to spend time together. Not quality time, but just quantity time. So in other words, even if things feel rough or there's argument or friction, you're still available. You're still there for the other person. And responsiveness is when other people say, I need you. Or let's say, in the words of John Gottman, one of the biggest researchers in this area, when somebody makes a bid for your attention to say, look, did you see that car that just went past? That you don't sort of just go back to reading or snub the thing off, but you respond. You say, why? What was important about that car? Because you have to be available to do that. But then when your partner actually says something to you or wants some of your attention, you give it.
That's right.
That's it. You just give it.
Or when they walk in, you know, in the room and you're on your computer, it's just an acknowledgement. It might be putting the screen away. It might be just a hi or whatever, you know, but just it's some responsiveness, you know.
Okay, so Caroline's touching a nerve here. Because I went through a phase where I was doing so much study on the computer that if somebody came into the room, I would still keep studying.
But I'd like to explain what happens in the brain.
I'll get there, okay, but let's get the story first.
All right, yes, if it's your confession time, then go ahead. I'm happy, I'm here, I'm ready and listening.
And I was doing this to my children.
You were.
Okay, and Caroline came up and said, look, when your children turn up, just close the computer, say hello, start having a conversation. And I'm a psychiatrist, I should know these things.
You should know these things.
But just like everybody else, I have a brain that gets distracted and easily engaged and identified with what's going on with the screen rather than what's going on with the people.
That's right. So can you explain to us what happens in the brain then?
So what happens in the brain to stop availability and responsiveness?
Yes.
All right. So there's a part of your brain. It's called the thalamus. And the thalamus is a bit like an FBI agent. The thalamus takes any bit of information that comes from the outside world into a room, shines a spotlight on it and says, yeah, so you want to get up to the brain, do you? Okay, why is what you have to say so important? And each part of information is actually screened by the thalamus to see if it's important enough to go up to the thinking part of your brain, the prefrontal cortex. And when you're on the computer, your brain is so engaged that it actually doesn't want to be disturbed, which means that the FBI agent kicks everybody else out, so that if you actually call somebody for dinner and they're on a computer game, they literally don't hear you. Sometimes you actually need to go up to them, tap them and say, it is dinner time, come on down, mm-hmm. right? And we get annoyed about that because it's showing that somebody is not available and not responsive to you as a person. So in other words, it's the opposite of what a good, committed relationship actually needs.
It's saying what I'm doing here and this is captivating more than me, more than you.
I know.
And that's really hard.
It is. It's really hard.
Yeah.
None of us want that message.
No,
none of us
right.
want to think that the internet is more important than we are.
Yeah. Well, thanks for explaining it in the brain because it actually makes sense. Obviously, they're getting whatever they need from the computer and they're valuing that over the person. And that's so hard.
Yeah. And the way that I see things, the internet and social media has a lot to answer for and has done a lot to keep us socially isolated. So one of the messages that will run through all of our episodes is to keep internet and social media use down to a minimum, just to be available and to be responsive to your partner.
That's exactly right. And I even use some of that knowledge of what the brain does in my work as a lecturer, and I actually get my students in their workshops to write notes in journals, actually hard copy, instead of having the computer screen in front of them, because I know that they're going to go into that passive mode. They won't listen to anything I say. And also, obviously, I teach theatre, I teach acting, and one of the key things in acting is reacting and responsiveness.
Yeah.
So acting isn't acting. Acting is reacting.
Yes.
And they're not going to be able to do that if they've got a screen in front of them because they're so involved in that world. So for the 3 hours, particularly in the workshops that I do with them, it is a phone-free, a screen-free time. So even if they're writing notes on what I'm saying, they have to handwrite it in a journal so their brain is fully sensorily alert and aware, and they're taking in everything, and they're alert and aware with each other because they've got to play relationships on stage. Theatre's all about relationships. So it's building that skill in them that they have lost in many ways.
Okay, so that must be quite difficult. How do your students react when you put those sort of parameters on?
Not very well. Initially, not very well. Although I have seen over the last few years, I'm getting more of a responsiveness and desire to put the screens away. It's actually making them a lot happier when they've actually done that. So I've challenged them to have technology-free days, and if they can't do a whole day, just a half a day or a few hours. And they're reporting back that they're feeling they didn't think they could do it. They thought they'd get really anxious, but they just have more peace in their life. They're not as frantic. They don't have as much anxiety. And it's really, really exciting to see.
Okay. So what differences do they see after a few weeks of a whole lot less internet screen time, social media?
Well, they're spending more time with friends. They're going out into nature. They're actually making choices. They're really enjoying things.
Okay, what about their imagination?
Well, yeah, that's a huge part of acting. Obviously, you have to have a really wonderful, developed imagination to be an actor. And I have noticed over the years that when I do any imaginary exercises, they can't imagine things. They're just imagining films or television shows and things in their mind. And that's a real problem because as actors, if you can't see what environment you're meant to be in, then the audience can't see it or the people watching the film can't see it. So you've got to have a very, very active imagination.
But what I found really encouraging was that you let me know that after a few weeks without screens, their imagination was coming back.
It was. And they're getting more creative in this. They're making different choices and they're playing a lot more. And the scenes that they're doing for their assessments and the plays that they're doing, we're seeing these imaginary worlds, and it's very exciting. And they're actually just Well, they're going to other creative things and they're choosing that instead of picking up their phone.
All right. One of the most creative things, and you've got to tell the story of the snakes and ladders game.
Oh, that's right. Okay. So put out the challenge, all right, that instead of games on your phone, play board games. So it was pretty exciting. One day I just put out a snakes and ladders game on the third floor where they all sort of hang out each day. And now every day I see someone playing snakes and ladders there. And not only that, they've taken it further every Tuesday night. And this is like, you know, this is a big cohort. There's 120 students. There's a group of them that get together every Tuesday night. They put their phones in a basket at the door and they play board games all Tuesday night.
Okay, now I've got to tie that in, the significance of that, to long-term relationships.
Okay.
Because let's say you out there are a university student or a college student and you're used to having your phone with you all the time. What Caroline has just talked about is an example of people getting together, enjoying themselves, and then socializing on a Tuesday night to play snakes and ladders and all sorts of board games. And they're interacting as people, which means that they are available and they are responsive to each other, which means they're actually getting to know each other more. They're going to be able to just feel each other out as to whether there's somebody there to have a relationship with. However, if your students got together on a Tuesday night and just sort of had their head in a smartphone all night long, they wouldn't get to know each other because they wouldn't be available to each other nor responsive to each other. So you'll find that one of my bugbears is getting people to close the lid of the computer, to shut down the social media, to be available to people around you. Because there are only two problems with relationships in our society at the moment. One, finding one. Number two, keeping it.
Yeah, it's true.
And social media and the internet adversely affects both of them. It's hard to find a relationship if you can't even talk to somebody because they or you are in a screen.
That's right.
And it's hard to keep a relationship if the world of screens becomes more important than the wonderful human being right next to you.
That's right. And I've seen them go from laughing at a screen to laughing together.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So much of
that's
a difference,
wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Okay, so we've looked at availability and responsiveness.
Okay, so to tie that back to commitment, because that's where we are at the moment, we're talking about commitment that a one-off historic commitment or a pledge or vows or a wedding day is not enough to show commitment.
Yeah.
That it's got to show availability and responsiveness on a day-to-day basis.
That's right.
Which means that spending time together, talking, interacting, even if they seem to be negative interactions, that shows commitment. I am here. I am ready to work through this in the long term.
Great. All right. Let's go to number two.
Number two.
No, let's move on to number two.
Number two.
Otherwise, we'll run out of time. Okay, so number two, of course, is altruism.
Altruism.
Shall I give you some of the nice little quotes that the couples gave me?
That'd
the
be
long-term
wonderful.
Couples.
That'd
okay,
be wonderful.
So they described altruism as putting yourself on the back burner, promoting your partner. I really like that one. Getting your ego out of the equation. Putting their needs first, obviously.
Yeah. So in the scientific world, there's a debate as to whether we are innately altruistic. Because since Richard Dawkins' book of 1976, The Selfish Gene, we've had this idea that we are innately selfish. And there's a reality in that. There is self-preservation, but if it weren't for altruism, we wouldn't survive as a species. So if you look all over the animal kingdom and in human beings, parents take care of their children willingly and altruistically. I'm sorry, but having children is a lot of work.
Oh my gosh, yes.
So it takes altruism just to do that. Or soldiers going into battle will take care of each other. That's a form of altruism as well. And even in our economy, where I'll pay you this amount of money if you give me those clothes that are on the rack there, there's altruism in that because each party needs to be fair and trustworthy. And if things like that break down, then we won't survive. If our economic system breaks down, the trust and the altruism in it goes away, then as a species, we will be in chaos. We won't survive.
Mm.
All right. Also, altruism is also going above and beyond. Those times when we give medals to heroes,
Yes.
Because they have saved somebody's life, a stranger's life. We applaud that. We admire that. We actually need it as a species. We can all aspire to something like that, even if we think that we're not all capable of things like that. It is part of our collective consciousness to know that there are people that will go over, above, and beyond just for the sake of humanity.
Mm. So that gets to a part of altruism that a lot of the couples did talk about, which
yes.
was sacrifice.
Sacrifice.
Not a very happy or much used word in our contemporary society. And why is that? Well, we really don't talk about it. We might talk about it in terms of war and things like that, but... Yeah, why don't we talk about it?
Yeah, well, I suppose sacrifice is the part of the equation that costs.
Mm.
And in our hyper-individual society, which we have at the moment, we're into pleasure, we're into self-gain. We want to know what can be done for us. So sacrifice, by its very nature, the way that I see it, says, no, this is going to cost you. However... I'm going to put a positive spin on sacrifice.
Okay, go ahead.
Scientifically validated that when you go over and beyond, and so in the context of a relationship, it's when your partner is sick and you've got to visit them in hospital, or you've got to take care of them, or you've got to feed them, or they're going through a really rough time and you've got to be there for them, mm. or they're just being an emotional jerk mm. and they're really making life hell for you. Altruism is just sticking through it
yeah.
to the point where, you know, after it's all over, you can say, you're an emotional jerk then, did you know that? And work through that around,
yeah.
rather than walking away. Here's the payoff. The payoff is this thing that's called in the literature a helper's high. The feeling of having been useful, the feeling of having given to somebody else, it leaves you singing with a feeling that's like no other because you've been immensely useful to somebody else.
Yeah.
You've gone through pain.
Yeah.
But when that pain has been useful... So a lot of people join the helping industries like being a nurse or a social worker or a doctor
yeah.
because of this feeling of a helper's high.
Yeah.
Right? Because the feeling that you are there being helpful to somebody.
And that can happen in relationships.
That can happen
most
totally
definitely.
In relationships.
Most definitely. You can get, I'm going for the helper's high then. It's a good thing.
Oh, come on. You feel great when I've been an emotional jerk. And, and finally, I see that it's my fault.
Oh, I do love that moment. Okay. I actually do think there is another good side in the altruism, a fun side.
Yes.
I want to share what one couple did.
Yes.
And they're actually an interesting couple. One was from America and one was from Australia, so it was a cross-cultural marriage. And they'd been married for over 40 years too, and they used to have a competition with altruism. So, okay, I'm going to be the first one today to make the bed. I'm going to be the first one to take the garbage out. I'm going to be the first one to unstack the dishwasher. No, I won. And they would do it. And they'd do it. They'd even do it with bigger things. And it became a game to them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really aspirational. I don't know if I'd get there. But but it was lovely to see that they'd actually turned it upside down. They'd inverted the whole concept of it being a drag or, I've got to think of you first or whatever.
It
became a game and it had a competitive element, which is kind of fun in a relationship too.
So this underscores actually the selfish element of being altruistic, because you talked about chores there, making the bed, taking the garbage out, doing the washing, whatever it happened to be. These are things that have to be done anyway, just to keep life moving, okay? And most of us begrudge doing it. Oh, gosh, got to do this, got to do that. But you're going to have to do it. So if you can enjoy doing it, and if you can get to an outcome in a fun way, the altruism means that you are putting yourself forward. You just want to make sure that you enjoy life. So if you can enjoy being generous, if you can enjoy helping other people, if you can enjoy being grateful, all of those sort of things means that you're just going to have a better quality of life. And in a sense, this shows the relationship between altruism and survival, because it takes effort to survive. For us to be here in the future for the next 1 or 5 years, it's going to take a lot of altruism from a whole lot of people. All of us are going to have to do what needs to be done to keep society on track to heading in a prosperous rather than a war-based or a degenerating society.
Mm.
We want to keep the order that we have so we can keep having parties and enjoying ourselves.
That's right. That's right. I do have to say, though, that altruism was a novel finding. Like, as in the literature, we didn't find any other studies that found altruism.
Okay.
And also in the context of society, because you're talking about society, it's a big step forward, which is a very self-based me society that says, look at my needs first. So it's a bit of a battle. It's actually harder for this generation than the generation that we interviewed, I believe.
It is harder. It is harder for all the young people out there. And it's people of our generation that have got to take responsibility for that.
Well, that's true.
In a way, it was always going to happen, because if you're prosperous, if you're doing well, which, quite frankly, for the last 60 years, we have been doing really well, you're going to start to take it easy. But what we're finding is that there's a downside to that. And we're sort of coming up against that now.
Mm.
All right, I just want to say that, you know how we talked about commitment coming up in the studies in the 80s and the 90s?
Yes.
That was in reflection, I believe, to all the no-fault divorce laws.
Yes.
And the relaxation of divorce laws. And people got together and sort of said, what we need to keep marriage together is commitment. So in our society, although it's really good to have all this individualism and all this prosperity, the downside is we're becoming quite selfish. So I think that the couples that you interviewed sensed that and articulated, you know what you need? The opposite of selfishness.
Mm.
And that's why altruism came up in this day and age.
Yeah.
Because we don't see that much of it in our society.
We don't see it, and especially in the relationship context.
In the relationship.
And that actually makes it harder for them to stay together, because they're thinking, well, what am I going to get out of this relationship? Instead of saying, what are we? So moving from the I to the we, which we'll talk about in another episode.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, because that's really good. Because let's say that you're just starting off in a relationship, that you've been together with somebody for a year, and you found out that it's a lot more work than you think it is, right? And you're having a little talk to yourself to sort of go, oh my gosh, this is more work than I thought it was. Don't be discouraged, because in a way that's the way it needs to be. We don't talk enough about how much work it actually is in the first year of marriage, and there seems to be some sort of expectation that if you get into a relationship, it's just all going to happen well.
Mm.
Unfortunately, it takes work, and this is the thing about altruism. It propels us into the future. It has a effort element now for a payoff in the future. But what Caroline said, to be we-focused rather than me-focused, takes us to glue secret number three.
It does. It most definitely does, which is shared values.
Shared values. What's a value, Caroline?
Oh, no, I'm not going to give that definition. You are. You're the psychiatrist. Off you go.
All right. Okay. My fault. Okay, so a value. So a value, the way I see it, is a standard or a principle or something that you hold in high esteem and has value, there go using the value, a word for a definition of value, to you personally. Now, there are hundreds and hundreds of things that can be of value to you.
Hmm.
But if you're able to share those with another person, let's say a value like honesty, or a value like commitment, or a value like family, or a value like fun, like a value like pleasure, like a value like
adventure.
Anything.
Yeah, anything. Money, the love of money. Going after, you know, money.
Yeah. The more that you share, the more that you're going to propel yourselves in the future together.
Yeah. And it was really interesting in our study, because obviously being of that next generation, the participants had often married young, and so they talked about forging their values together.
Hmm.
And so it was a bit easier for them in a way, because they went straight into the we instead of staying in the me, and there wasn't the clash of values, which there often is, and that's always a problem with values.
Yes. In fact, if you look at the culture wars that we're going through at the moment and all the laws that are looking to be changed, the different party politics, it all has to do with value clashes. It has to do with one group of people valuing one lifestyle and another group of people valuing another lifestyle.
Mm.
That's what we're going through at the moment.
Mm.
So elsewhere on our website, we talk about how to find your values, like what you admire in yourself and others, that points to your values.
What are the other questions? So that's what, let's go through the questions.
You want to go through the questions?
Yeah, why don't you? It's to help people find their individual and then together values.
Okay. Okay. So there's an acronym that I've introduced called ARMED, A-R-M-E-D, be armed with your values. So A is for admire, R is for right, M is for motivate, E is for esteem, and D is for die. So let me go through all of those. I just want people to remember it. Okay, so what do you admire in yourself and others? If you admire somebody's honesty, if you admire somebody's strength, if you admire somebody's vulnerability, whatever it is, that will point you in the direction of what you value.
So these are really good to write down, by the way, if you've got a pen and paper. It's all right. I get my students to do it, so I'm doing the lecturer thing. That's here. Fine. Anyway, go ahead.
The R is for right. What is the right thing to do? What do I believe is the right thing for me to do? Because we actually all have rules that we live by. And we're not always conscious of those rules. But if you know what your own personal rules are, that will point you to what you value in life. So the M is motivation. What motivates you? If you have to write that essay or if you have to study for that exam, how are you going to reward yourself? What is it that you actually want to get? And it's not just a party or going out at night. It's also, I value getting a degree. I value passing. I value feeling good about myself, whatever it happens to be. Whatever motivates you becomes part of your values. E is, when do you feel full of self-esteem and self-respect? So when do you feel good about yourself? When you do things that make you feel good about yourself, that points you to your values. And the last one is a bit challenging in that if you knew that you were going to die within a year, what would all of a sudden become important to you? And knowing the answer to that question will point you in the direction of your values.
That's right. So once you've actually, this is our application part, if you've worked out your own values and then you sit down with your partner and you work on what your together values are. Where are those connections? How are we forging our values together? What do we value that's outside of even our family of origins values? What are our values? What's our new family, you and I? What are our values?
Yeah. So to forge together values, it might be a new value that neither of you have had. It may be the love of money, as you mentioned. It may be the love of working on a charity. It may be ambition that you want to do things together. Or you may look at where you overlap. There would have been some things that attracted you to each other, and all those things are actually values-based.
That's right.
And so the more that you can consciously understand what your values are, the more you can say, hey, we ought to spend time doing this, right, and less time doing that. The other thing is, as the years go by in a relationship, sometimes we let go of the things that you actually did together for fun that was actually a value, because life gets serious all of a sudden.
Especially when kids come along.
That's right, that's right. Mortgages become more important than meals, all right?
Yeah,
but it wasn't a value when you first went out.
Yeah,
okay. So
exactly.
The idea is to change but also keep some of those fun values as well.
That's right. And there's also the tie-in where a lot of the couples that I interviewed, actually, interestingly, opposite personalities was one of the glues that kept the some of the couples together. But those that did have opposite personalities were very, very clear. And they said, we have opposite personalities, but we have the same values.
Oh, that is so important.
It is, isn't
That's
it?
That's so good.
Yeah. And there was at least three that actually said those words to me.
Yeah.
And that's what kept them together. So even though they had really different personalities, and the studies are showing now that opposite personalities do attract.
Well, not only attract, but can actually keep each other together.
That's right.
Because you dovetail, okay? What one person doesn't have, the other person may have.
That's right.
So you can make your personalities work for you, not against you.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that was their glue then. So their values were their glue. These are obviously the couples that said that shared values was the secret for their marital longevity. Yeah.
So that sort of underscores the importance of shared values.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So just on opposite personalities, because, okay, so a lot of people get hung up on this idea about compatibility, that I have to find somebody who's compatible with me. And if we're not working out, it means that we're not compatible. Look, the way I see it, it's actually not true. Because if you want a relationship to last, it doesn't matter if you're compatible or not. And what the science is showing, that you don't have to be compatible to stay in a relationship. You just have to want to stay in a relationship.
Yes.
Which is why these top three things that we're talking about today, I'm kind of going to wrap things up so that we've got take-home messages for each of them.
Yeah.
The commitment, the shared values, and the altruism, not in that order, commitment, altruism, and shared values are the things that kind of keep a relationship together.
Yeah.
And I've got to go to one other piece of science.
Go.
Because when you see these three things come together, what the science shows is that it is these three things that have a close interaction with each other and the relationship itself.
Mm.
Now, for commitment, it's quite obvious, okay? If you're not committed to a relationship, you don't have a relationship, okay? The stronger the commitment, the stronger the relationship, the more you'll take care of each other. So, in other words, altruism doesn't become sacrifice, that really difficult word.
Yeah.
It becomes something that you want to do.
Mm.
You want to help your partner because they become part of you. They are part of your life. You're actually helping yourself. So it's not altruism anymore. You're just doing the right thing.
It's the most selfish thing that you can do.
It's the most selfish thing.
We will say that a lot.
Yeah. So, and shared values, of course, are the things that you share to spend time together with. So just to apply this to your relationship or what to look for in a relationship, commitment, not just a one-off, I'm married to you, these are our vows, or we're going exclusive, but absolutely to show it every day in terms of availability and responsiveness.
That's right. It's great.
Yeah. And availability and responsiveness is, in a sense, altruism. You've actually got to be a mensch, a human being capable of giving to somebody else. And find that in you and share that with your love partner, whoever it happens to be.
Mm.
Early on in a relationship, you will need to protect yourself because as you're getting to know somebody, you don't want to get abused, right? But once you've made that commitment and the two of you said, yep, we're here, we're in it for the long haul, it's going to take some altruism, some of which is not going to feel too good, but most of which ends up feeling quite good. Yeah. And in a way, the most practical way to do that is to know your shared values. Know what you both like, know what you both value, know what you both share, so that you become more we-focused rather than me-focused.
But it's not easy. We know. We're opposite personality. We know. Okay. We have been through a lot. So it isn't easy. It isn't easy. And none of the couples that I interviewed, there was a few that said, no, we're fine. We've been happy. But I would say a good, 90% of them said have been through rough times, but they've found that the adversity made them stronger and the adversity even strengthened their commitment because they were more we-focused than me-focused as they went through it. And I think that is one of the keys too. Well, but that's part of altruism.
Yeah, it is. It is. So although it's effort, there's a lot of fun along the way. But the most thing that I suppose I'd like to emphasize is the idea that it's worthwhile.
Yeah.
It brings meaning to life. Whatever your belief system is, whatever your value system is, life takes on new and deeper meaning because of a long-term relationship.
Well, yeah, it's not just you anymore. It's a whole other life. And that's the we, isn't it?
That's the we.
Yeah. Okay.
Shall we leave it there?
We shall. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with another episode, looking always each week at some science and some application and even some brain stuff thrown in there. We'll often look at a journal article in the relationship area and give you some really great tips for long-term relationships. But if you want to find any of the material we've been talking about, you can go to our website, drchristianheim.com. And there you'll find our blog, you'll find other podcasts on mental health, and you will find a YouTube channel where we've got some other information about. Christian did talk a lot about screen use, and we've got some social media addiction videos up there too. So all of that material is up there. It's on our website. But we are so glad that you joined us today, and we're really looking forward to your company next time.
We'll see you next fortnight.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.